I'm on the phone today with David Humes, MD. He was born in South Africa and received his medical training at the Witwatersrand Medical School in Johannesburg. Specializing in urology, Dr. Humes was trained and has previously taught on the staff at Stanford Medical Center. He has published extensively in professional journals and currently has a private practice in Santa Barbara, California. He has published 3 books. In the first book, Inner Passages, Outer Journeys, Dr. Humes explores the restorative power of nature, discusses the practical theories of wilderness psychology, and synthesizes relevant aspects of ancient traditions such as yoga and Kabbalah. His second book is The Spirit of Healing, and he discusses the interrelationship between the patient, the healer, and the divine force or field. I could say more about Dr. Humes, but I will ask you, Dr. Dave Humes, could you tell people what you would like them to know about you?
Well, yeah, just talking about the 3 books, there's been a transition that went from looking at wilderness, spiritual practice and healer, to understanding the general principles of healing. And serendipitously, hanging around curanderos or medicine men and women in Peru for about 7 years, that gave me a lot of deeper insights into healing wisdom, which really led to the third book and the third, and the, I guess maybe the final chapter of my life, which is now Indigenous African medicine, after being initiated in South Africa in between 2002 and 2003. I sort of underwent 2 initiations with 2 separate sangomas, which is basically a Zulu word for shaman.
Okay, and this was with the son of the Kalahari?
No, the son of the Kalahari is who inspired me to do the book on wilderness, because I spent extended periods of time with them and got to appreciate the incredibly intimate connection with nature, and made me understand this concept of wilderness rapture that I talk about in the first book. But the San Bushmen have a completely different healing system to the Bantu people of South Africa. The Bantu being, you know, the African people. The San are much more Asian in their appearance. Mm-hmm. They have high cheekbones and peppercorn hair, short stature, copper-colored skin. And they are, you know, they've said for years that they were the original people, and now genetic studies is actually proving that they were correct. So they probably started the healing traditions, you know, going way back as far as 30,000 years ago, because you can see it on their rock art. Mm-hmm. But they use an incredible healing dance called the trance dance, where they go into a trance and they travel out of body into the spirit realm. And then they get information from the spirits as to their healing, and then they use spiritual energy to heal with hands on the group. Now, in the African paradigm, is somewhat different. It's more about having a spirit guide who's connected to you, mm-hmm. either overtly in terms of sangoma becoming possessed by the spirit, which really we would call in the West trans channeling. But it's much more dramatic when you see it in Africa, because literally, you know, the person that you know steps aside and the spirit comes in and you sometimes can't even recognize the person. Everything changes. Mm-hmm. So that's one way that they get diagnostic information, is the spirit who's not localized in space and time, and hence can be in Africa and in Santa Barbara and, you know, in Santa Fe all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And also not localized, that's not localized in space, also not localized in time. So the spirit has access to your karmic life book and can assess your present situation, being non-local, and can see somewhat into the future, not all the way because of free will. Mm-hmm. Free will determines the future, and you know, free will depends on how many variables there are. So the spirit is very gifted in the sense that although they are just human spirits, you know, they're not necessarily enlightened beings, they can come into the Sangoma's body and give information that's not local, that's very, very, very accurate. Mm-hmm. The other way they do it, in my case, you know, I think because of my cultural roots, possession wasn't really on the cards for me, but the way my spirit guide does it, who's a black woman who was a Sangoma in a previous life and now wanted to work through me because she didn't quite complete what she did in her previous life, she is present in consultation with me when I do bone divinations. Mm-hmm. So that essentially what happens is that when I throw bones, really the spirit guides with an energy field throws the bones so that they do not fall in a random fashion. They fall in a non-random fashion that can be read by me, the messenger. Mm-hmm. But in reality, without the spirit guide, you know, my bones would be pretty much unintelligible. But mm-hmm. because she throws it in such a fashion that I can read it, she's the conveyor of spirit wisdom from the other side, from across the veil, that, you know, I would not have access to without her. So, you know, we kind of form a bond, a liaison, where she helps me do my work and I help her in a way bump up her karma on the other side by doing service on the other side. Because when we cross over to the other side, pretty much that's it. You know, we cannot do anything about our karma except if we sign up with somebody who we can assist on this side. So we basically lose free will the minute we go over to the other side. We have to work through somebody else's free will. So the third way that they get diagnostic information, the first, possession, second, being possessed, but less overtly, more, you know, sort of implicitly by the spirit, is with the bone divination. And the third is with dreams, because the spirit guide can script your dreams. And dreams are a particular interest of mine, and there's a whole other subject in and of itself. So that's really how the ancestral spirits work to help us help on this side. And they are kind of the intermediaries between us and the Great Spirit, because the Great Spirit for most of us is a bit too remote. We can't mm-hmm. communicate directly unless we were enlightened beings. So it's a very practical sort of thing. If you've lost your cow, you can go to Sangoma and the Sangoma can tell you, you know, where it is, or if you'll ever have a chance of getting it back, or was it, you know, you've already eaten, or was it stolen, and this kind of stuff. So it's very, very useful day-by-day information, you know, because if you follow the Eastern tradition, mostly, you know, you get that kind of information, but you almost have to become an enlightened guru before you can get it. Whereas in Africa, you can just go down the road and you can speak to the local Sangoma and he'll throw the bones or get possessed, give you the answers that you need.
And you consult with people and throw the bones for them, and you may do that even over the phone?
Yes, you know, because it's not local, it doesn't matter where you do it. You can do it on email, over the phone, or in my yurt that I practice. The yurt sort of is the closest thing I could find to what the Africans call an Ndumba, a healing hut, where my ancestor can feel comfortable. You know, she needs to have a place that she enjoys being in. So yeah, it can be done anywhere, but it's easier to do with somebody there because it's more interactive.
Yes.
And they can see the bones, and then they can intervene and take the questions in another way. The reading is always extremely democratic because basically the bones are reading the waking dream that is the person's life. So, you know, if you were to come to me and offer me one of your dreams, and I would offer an interpretation, at the end of the day, it's your dream. You are the final arbitrator of the dream that's your life. And you might say, no, that doesn't fit. You know, then I have to take your dream and say, well, how about this interpretation? Because there could be more than several interpretations of the mm-hmm. dream, and then you could say, yeah, that one actually fits. It's exactly the same with the bones, so that when you go to Africa, they always want feedback. They say, do you agree? Mm-hmm. Do you agree? You know, Siabuma, do you agree? Mm-hmm. And if you don't, then they go in another direction with the dream. The dream is real. The interpretation is, you know, is democratic.
Mm-hmm. Dave, you're of Jewish ancestry, is that correct?
Yes. This was a bizarre thing because, you know, the reality is that when I went to Peru, I would go and spend time with the curanderos, and I knew about the sangomas and the bushmen. I always knew they had tremendous power. But I never thought that I, you know, firstly had the cultural, and I could cross the cultural gap.
Right.
And I thought that would be out of the question. And I never thought I had any psychic abilities. And, you know, I always looked at it as an observer. I would go to Peru and, you know, be involved in the rituals as an observer, and I'd learn stuff from it, but I never actually thought that I could be a curandera.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went back to South Africa, what happened after the first book is I formed a company called Inward Bound, and Inward Bound's mission statement was to take people into wild places to connect with this idea of wilderness rapture. So I went to the Kalahari, I went to different parts of South Africa, I went to Peru, even the Sinai Desert and California, places in California. But when I would go to South Africa, before I would check in with the group, I would go to Sangoma and I would say, please help me, you know, I'm having a group, can you tell me how the group's going to go? Are we going to have any difficulties? What should I expect?
Yes.
They would always answer my questions, but they would, at the end of the reading, they would say, you know, the ancestors on your mother's side are calling you, they're telling you to do our work, this work, the bone of a nation, the plant medicines, the dreams. And I couldn't believe it. At first I thought, well, that's kind of curious. You know, it happened first to me in a place in Zimbabwe, and the guy said to me, he read me up and down like a book, so I couldn't believe, you know, how accurate he was. And then he said, one day you'll be doing my work. And I thought, yeah, likely story. Then I went to go and see another Sangoma somewhere else, and they would say the same thing. And always it was the ancestors on my mother's side.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's not a cultural thing because I've been a black person at least twice before in previous lives. You know, we cycle in and out of different incarnations. Sometimes we're Celtic, sometimes we're Jewish, sometimes we're black, sometimes, you know, we may be Muslim, who knows, we may be Sufi. This is why, in essence, none of this information belongs to anybody because, you know, I might have been a Native American in a previous life. Does that mean I can't do Native American healing in this life? You know, it doesn't make sense at all. So the first thing that happened when I found my teacher, you know, I was like blown away that an African, a Zulu, an old Zulu in South Africa would teach me, you know, a white person who, after he'd been victimized by, you know, the apartheid system, and he would say, this has nothing to do with color or race, you know. If the ancestors call you, then we must initiate you. And, you know, he wouldn't have initiated me unless he would have, he ascertained not only with his bone divination, but with another person who did Femba, which is a whole other story, that my ancestors were calling me to do this work, and that in reality, the black woman had worked for my grandfather on my mother's side, and she wanted to come and work with me in this way. So, anyway, my grandfather, who I never knew, was the first one who connected me in the dreams with this woman in Porfu, who is my guide. And I have now many more than one guide. But gradually, you know, as I started to get initiated more and more, I signed on with different guides. The guides are only helpful with their particular specialty in their previous life, you know. They're in the astral plane. So, for instance, they have to network together. You know, I may have a surgical guide who'll help me with surgery, and then I have Mporfu who helps me with bones. And I have my ex-father-in-law who passed on, who was a lawyer, who helps me with business decisions. So it's very, very specialized. You know, it's really quite an amazing technology that nobody really understands in the West. I think we're beginning to understand it, and they don't even understand it anymore in South Africa, because although some of them will go and visit a Sangoma, very few of them really understand what it's about and how it works. And that's what I try to explain in the third book, you know, Africa and My Bones, is kind of about my initiation, but not so much about that as to how the mechanisms work through my understandings of integrative medicine and the principles of how healing works. But in reality, it's very similar to, you know, whether you're a Peruvian shaman. In the Americas, they tend to use mind-altering substances to get connected with the spirit guides. Whereas in Africa, they use drumming and dancing. They do use entheogens or mind-altering plants in very special circumstances. But yeah. In the Americas, there are many, many safe plants that have been used for generations.
Well,
in Africa, the margin between death and a pharmacological effect is quite narrow. So you have to be very expert if you're going to use some of these medicinal plants in Africa. But in the Americas, that tends to be what they use. But the principles are the same, whether you're Navajo, whether you're Zulu, or whether you're Quechua and Indian. You know, everybody is using the tools that they have through their culture, but the principles, I think, are identical.
Well, I would like to go back to your grandfather.
Yeah.
And perhaps we can use the example of your grandfather for you to be able to speak more about how we can reconnect with our ancestors and receive help and guidance from our ancestors.
Absolutely.
Whether they...
A really good question, because we all have ancestors and we can all receive help. But like it says in the Bible, ask and you will receive. The reason for that is because of free will. Free will is the cosmic law, the divine law. It cannot be abrogated. So in order to receive, you have to ask. You can't assume your ancestors will come and help you. And also you have to establish a relationship. Now, the thing about Africa, where it's so far advanced, and this is true for all sub-Saharan Africa, the principles are the same throughout. They have methods to get you in touch with your ancestors so that you can form a relationship more quickly than maybe you could in the West. And that's what they do, of course, when you become initiated. That's a big part of initiation, is to contact with you, with your ancestors. But here we can do it very easily. And what I recommend is setting up an altar or a shrine. White is the color of ancestors, so I usually tell people to put down a white cloth and then put pictures of the ancestors that loved you and that you loved. You don't necessarily have to have known them, because I never knew my grandfather at all. He died long before I was born. But somehow they connected to you from the other side, maybe in a past life. And they don't have to be your blood root relatives, although probably at some stage they were your blood root relatives. Mm-hmm. This is why, you hear people saying, I have a Tibetan spirit guide, and I have an Egyptian spirit guide. And I often used to think when I first got to California, that's ridiculous. Why would that be the case? Well, that Tibetan spirit guide may have been your mother, in a previous life. And, Buddhists have this meditation where you should look on all people as your mother, because in fact they might have been. So I think one has to look beyond our immediate blood root relatives to a much more cosmic appreciation of spirit guides, and start a relationship with anybody who you loved or who loved you or in some way was connected with you, maybe even an inspirational figure that's been a teacher to you through books or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be surprised, you might show up in your dreams or in other ways. And I think the important thing is not important that you know who they are. What's important is that you show respect and love, and you don't take the relationship for granted. It's a relationship like anything else. The only difference is they're on the other side and you can't see them. But you can't kind of just call them when you need something. You have to develop the relationship much like a pen pal. You can't just write to the pen pal when you're having trouble with your relationship, for instance. You've got to keep the conversation ongoing. And the altar is the way to do this, so that you have your photographs there. You have little mementos from them. I was always encouraged by the Sangomas, to put anything that belonged to them there to show them that you love them, that you respect them. And then, on occasions like Thanksgiving or Easter, or if you have a special family meal, you invite them to come and you talk to your family about them, and you talk to your children about them and your grandchildren about them, so that in the Zulu sense they say Pagamisa, you lift them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because by being known on this side and by being appreciated and by being honored, it helps them tremendously on the other side. Most of us just forget who they are, and we don't even know who they were. I think the other thing is one, you know, has to be careful who you invite. You don't want to invite somebody who may have been malicious or nasty or something like that.
Exactly. I was wondering. I think that
anybody can have this kind of spirit guide practice. And another way to do it, especially if you're a dreamer, and even if you're not, is dreams are the most powerful way that they can come to you and send you messages. You know, just having a dream journal or starting up a dream practice, putting your dream journal next to your bed or a tape recorder or asking for dreams. You have to be specific about anything you ask for because of free will. You know, for instance, with the bones, people sometimes come into the yurt and they say, well, can you tell me what I must be doing with my life? Well, you can't do that because that abrogates free will. But you can say, do you think I should become a doctor, you know, now? And then you can throw for that and the ancestors will help you. So the more specific the question, either in the dream time or to the bone, the more you don't get into the problem of free will and issues around that where they won't answer. But I would say that the most creative way you can define your ancestral practice, the better. You know, put books there that you like, bring a flower, light incense, light a candle. When you have a meal, put out a plate of food for them. Mm-hmm. Whenever the Africans have some kind of ritual, they feed their ancestors. They either give them mealie-meal, they might do a sacrifice. And, you know, sacrifices clearly won't go down well in the West, but the best way to get the ancestors' attention is with animal sacrifice, because the cry of the sacrificial animal immediately gets the attention of the ancestors and they will come on board. Now, I have other methods to do that here. You know, blowing a kudu horn and doing medicinal plants convey messages very, very well to the ancestors. They're very powerful passwords to the ancestral realm. But, you know, that's getting into more the postgraduate stuff. But we can all develop a relationship, we can all ask, and we can all appreciate, and basically it's all about gratitude and love. Love is the catalyst that gets your message across the veil. This is why, you know, a mother will dream about her daughter 3,000 miles away going into labor, but she won't dream about her neighbor going into labor next door, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the love connection.
So I'm curious, for instance, if some of our ancestors died in concentration camps or during the war and they have suffered terribly, how can we care for them? How can we participate in repairing that across the world?
That's a tough question, because some of them, you know, one of the issues that I deal with a lot in my practice are intrusive spirits, which are usually ancestral spirits who need to be released from some terrible thing that they may have done to people that are still living. Forgiveness allows them to not have to come back again and revisit that particular problem, that particular issue in their next lifetime. You know, that's why the Bible says the sins of the fathers and the mothers, in a sense, are visited upon the children,
mm-hmm.
which means that you get reincarnated usually back into the same bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
If you were an alcoholic and you physically abused your son, then you'll come back into the same bloodline, maybe as a great-grandchild with the same dysfunction and so on. So that doesn't apply so much to your question, but what does apply to your question is earthbound spirits. Sometimes people have traumatic deaths, get earthbound and hang around the living as, you know, thinking in a sense that they're still alive and being stuck between the worlds.
Ooh.
So sometimes that kind of thing needs to be appreciated, and, you know, it often manifests as depression, bad dreams, bad luck, things going wrong in your life. This kind of thing can be a symptom or a sign of either an intrusive spirit looking for forgiveness or an earthbound spirit hanging around, not stuck between the worlds. And these people, you know, you can go to a psychic or a shaman or a sangoma or a curandera, doesn't matter, and they can say, oh, your grandfather maybe died in the concentration camp and is hanging around, is earthbound, And then rituals can be made to that person to help them move into the light, which would be very, very good, because there's nothing good about being stuck. You know, you've got to go over to the other side and complete your karma. And most of them, when they know they're stuck between the worlds, they move over, and then the ancestral spirits can help guide them to the other side. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that can be done for these people. But, you know, the other thing that can be done is just to include them in your memories, in your prayers. You know, the Jews have prayers for the dead. Many times just having their pictures, even hanging up or just remembering them at special occasions is really important for them, for that same reason that I spoke about earlier. But the reality is that, you know, many of those people that die during war or die in concentration camps or any traumatic death, whether it's suicide, alcohol, car accident, that's a common cause of an earthbound spirit. And, you know, the Zulu people, when their warriors went to war, they would disembowel their victims because it was hand-to-hand combat, and they would apologize to them. And they would say, look, nothing personal. They would release their spirit so they could go over to the other side. Two good reasons. One is to release the spirit from the traumatic effect of the death so they're not confused. The other was so they wouldn't be haunted by a vengeful spirit later on, you know, which might be a lot of to do with post-traumatic stress disorder. Uh-huh. You know, the Native Americans do much better than the psychiatrists do with their soldiers who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, I think probably because of this appreciation. And then when the Zulus would return from battle, they would be cleansed by the Sangomas to make sure there were no spirits hanging around. So this is the kind of thing that's very hard to do on a huge level. This is one reason why I would never, for instance, want to go and visit Auschwitz or something like that, because there must be lots of earthbound spirits hanging around there, and maybe around the World Trade Center. They hang around jails and hospitals, and, you know, they hang around war fields and cemeteries. And, you know, it can affect the living as well, especially if you're very sensitive.
Yeah.
So, you know, I haven't given you a solution to the problem, but what you talk about is very, very significant. And, you know, it's well known that Holocaust, the children of Holocaust victims, even those children who've never, ever been told that their parents or their grandparents were in the Holocaust, will often have these frightening dreams, which might be an ancestral spirits hanging around and, in a sense, imprinting this memory on them. There are many ways to look at that, but that might be one of them.
Right. I want to ask you, Dave, how do you intertwine, how do you match Western medicine and your knowledge of African healing?
Yes, it's a dance between two worlds, and, you know, the thing is the two complement each other. We have magic in Western medicine, and, you know, I think people who fail to appreciate that are missing out on a lot, and that's interesting to me. So many people are turning towards traditional healing, which is a good thing if Western healing has failed them, but they turn to it immediately. And Western medicine has so much to offer. You know, the technology is astounding. Nobody would doubt, you know, the value of a computer. So why would they doubt the value of, you know, Western medicine? And I have no trouble, you know, operating where it's necessary. But there are certain conditions Western medicine and even psychiatry does not address. For instance, the ones I've touched on, intrusive spirits, earthbound spirits, energetic pollution, witchcraft and sorcery. You know, there's nothing in Western thinking that regards these things as anything but nonsense or superstitious or rubbish or so on. And this is what African medicine can bring, as well as the appreciation of ancestors and what they can do for the living and how they can help us with issues not localized in space and time. So I really have a dual practice. I throw bones in my yurt from my home, and I go to my office and I use antibiotics and surgery and drugs for anything that's allopathic. Even the medicinal plants that I use, I don't usually use them for allopathic complaints, for physical complaints that I can treat far more effectively with Western methods. But I do use medicinal plants for psycho-spiritual problems, bad luck, intrusive spirits, witchcraft, and that sort of thing. So the two complement each other exactly, and you know, frequently in South Africa, they're growing up as a, you know, qualifying there. We were told, well, you know, these people just don't know what they're doing, and they do terrible things, and we would only see the complications of their trade. But in reality, for eons now, people have been getting better with medicinal plants. And if you don't have a CAT scan and if you don't have an operating room, then it's very, very important medicine, because firstly, sangomas and shamans in general have an ability with their charisma and their personality and their magic in a way to enhance the placebo effect. Whereas the Western, you know, the things we can learn from them is that Western medicine is always trying to discount placebo. We did double-blind trials to get rid of the placebo effect, which means the power of belief. We know the power of belief cures people 30% of the time. You know, if you give a dummy medicine, it'll work 30% of the time. We're looking for a therapeutic effect over and above placebo. But if you're a powerful shaman and you can increase placebo maybe to 70%, then the power of belief can literally cure anything, including, you know, terrible cancer. We know this from spontaneous remissions usually occurring in people with a strong spiritual belief system. And then there's the new idea of an integrative medicine of distant healing, which is the ability of prayer or distant healing to work and bypass even the placebo effect, because the person doesn't even know they're being prayed for, so they can't have a belief in it. And for I believe that for eons, sangomas have been using distant healing in a sense that comes through a plant where the ancestor uses universal healing energy, which is basically God's love in disguise, to heal the person. So if you think of somebody out in the bush in South Africa and he has nothing except medicinal plants, he has a very powerful tool for diagnosis. You know, he'll tell you something's wrong with your heart. He might not know it's your left descending coronary artery, but he'll then throw the bones and find a heart problem. And then he'll give a ritual with medicinal plants, which probably have some pharmacological effect and have a tremendous placebo effect, and also a password to the ancestral spirits to come, hey guys, help this fellow out here and let's heal him. And they, and you know, 80% of Africans, especially rural Africans, will rather see a sangoma than see a Western doctor first. Mm-hmm. Only when the sangoma medicine fails do they go to see the Western doctor. And it's expensive, the medicine. You know, it's not free. The people, you know, they've been using this for a long time. They wouldn't use it if it didn't work.
Mm.
And it might be take a full month's salary to pay the sangoma for all the work that he's doing. And they clearly do it because it works. And sadly, there are a lot of charlatans around as well. But the good sangomas have very, very good therapeutic effects. And my sense is that it's a combination of placebo, which is the belief in the sangoma, the ancestral spirits working with God's universal healing energy, and probably also, in many instances, some pharmacological effect of the medicine itself, all going together to create a good effect. Maybe not as good as we would do with certain things. Clearly, they're not going to be able to do as well with fractures or an appendicitis or anything like this.
Right.
But when it comes to psycho-spiritual and social issues, they do far better than we do, much better than we do. And they've got medicines for just about anything, from love to luck to witchcraft to somebody who may have aborted a child. There's special medicines even in Venda, where I worked for many years, which is the most traditional part of Southern Africa, still for children in the first 6 months of life, to protect them, because my sense is this is one of the reasons for crib death, is that when the child comes into the planet from the other side, it's very close to the spirits on the other side and maybe is going back and forth in the dream time, and it wouldn't be difficult for a spirit to be taken back or to accidentally go back to the other side unknowingly or maybe even knowingly. And it's for this reason the Venda, for instance, have many traditions, amulets, medicines, rules and regulations that they give for kids in the first 6 months of life to protect them. And I'm sure it might have something to do with this phenomenon of, you know, in some way the spirit being taken back to the other side and the child has a mysterious death. So, you know, to answer to your original question way back, that's where the combination of the two, I think, is so phenomenal, because the one addresses things that the other one doesn't address.
Yes, thank you. Now, I would like to ask you, could you speak about the role that wilderness plays in personal healing and transformation?
Yes, that's a very big one. You know, to me, the big medicine is wilderness medicine, and that's why when I found my healing center in South Africa, I wanted to go back to the original model, the so-called Garden of Eden archetype, where everything was still there like it was in the beginning, mm-hmm. The animals, the plants, and so on. Just being in that environment is incredibly healing, and you know, it would take me a long time to go into all the reasons why. But I think the problem with us in the West is we've lost a touch with our primal selves, with our indigenous selves, and we're very poorly off for it. You know, we're so captivated with left brain phenomena, and our education is so centered on the left brain, on, you know, acquisitive cognitive knowledge that's very, very goal-oriented and didactic, as opposed to the right brain, more feminine, intuitive, compassionate, receptive knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where we come short. Now, in Africa, of course, they don't have the educational system we have, but they're much more tuned in, they're much more able to get information from dreams, they're much more able to see spirit energies and spirit medicines. And I think this ability comes from being exposed to nature. The Bushmen are probably the ultimate examples. To me, they're the most powerful healers. They're incredibly intuitive. And this is our birthright. This is how we used to be. We all came from Africa. We all were Bushmen at one stage, hunter-gatherers. We all had this early warning system that kept us out of trouble. We all had dreams. We all talked to each other about dreams probably before we ate our meal in the morning. Mm. And now we've lost all that, you know, and more it's computers and movies and video games, and it's this hypnosis of materialism that pulls us more and more away, not only spiritually from our roots, but from our indigenous roots, which is, you know, a tragedy. And the environment, of course, is being terribly impacted. We're raping the Garden of Eden, yeah, and pillaging it. So, you know, it's hard even to find anymore. For me to go back to South Africa and find the Garden of Eden archetype, I had to fly back, you know, 30 hours in the plane, drive 6 hours north of Johannesburg, take a 4x4 up to the top of the mountain for another hour and a half, and then I was in the Garden of Eden archetype. Well, not many people can do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it was only for, you know, maybe at the most 3 months at a time. So this is the tragedy, is that we need to go back to our roots. And this is why people have such phenomenal experiences when they go back to their roots, when they go into nature, when they go back to Africa. They kind of find a lost part of themselves they didn't even know was there. And if we do that more and more, we can tune back into the right brain and hopefully regain our birthright, you know.
Mm-hmm. So wilderness.
Yeah, wilderness rapture, you know. For me, I never got into any rapturous spaces with yoga or with meditation like I did in wilderness. And that was my philosophy with Inward Bound, you know. My idea was, if you took people out for 5 days or more, and you separated them as much as possible from their creature comfort so that they slept on the earth, and they, you know, they could sort of be very close to the Earth Mother, then they started to experience this wilderness rapture. So much so that, you know, the psychologists talk about it. There's a re-entry depression when they come back. The people are, you know, they don't know what to do with themselves. They feel very depressed. You have to, mm-hmm, kind of tell them that they're going to be depressed for 3 weeks until, of course, they adjust back to their abnormal psychotic state of being in a normal, in a non-psychotic state in the wilderness.
Yes, yes. I want to ask you, Dave Kumes, we're going to bring this conversation around, and I'd like you to think about what you'd like to say to the good people who are listening, what you'd like to say.
Yeah, I think the two things I'd say is get back into nature at whatever level you can, even in your garden, and have a spiritual practice that doesn't have to be yoga, tai chi, or meditation. It can be any inner practice that is done for its own sake, whether it's windsurfing or whether it's art or gardening. But if you want to have a garden, you mustn't try and make your garden be the best garden in the neighborhood. You must just relate to the plants and the earth and get into your garden. That, you know, if you can't get into wilderness, that's a very good substitute. The closer you can get to the hunter-gatherer archetype, and people can download the book Inner Passages, Outer Journeys from the website for free, you know, davidkumes.com, and read some of those principles. It'll get, you know, give you a better appreciation of how possibly to let nature help you have a spiritual practice. But some kind of inner practice would be the first thing, and the closer you can get to the wilderness or to nature would be the second thing. And the third thing I would say was speak to your ancestors, revere your ancestors, don't hesitate to ask them for things, but don't be concerned if they don't speak to you back, because that's the thing, you know, we want results, we want our signs to come in neon lights, and you know, the messages that come from nature and from the ancestors are very subtle, you know, they're kind of, you have to listen softly for the whisper, you know, I think the Bible talks about the soft word of God. Well, that's kind of what you have to listen for. You have to look for power animals, you have to look for signs in nature, you have to look at your dreams. And the more technology we surround ourselves with, the more trouble we're going to have getting this information coming to us. The more you get into nature, then the easier it comes to you. You know, if you go out into nature for extended periods of time, your dreams will shift and you'll start to get more like the Bushman, you know, model.
Excellent. Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. David Kumes, for your generosity of time and thought.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Good.
Future Primitive is made possible by the Marian Institute. If you enjoyed these podcasts, please consider supporting our work by making your own tax-deductible contribution online at futureprimitive.org.